Chapter 33. When she arrived at Pemberley, Mary's first feeling was one of relief. Here, there was no one to insult her or make her miserable. Instead, Elizabeth greeted her with a most welcoming smile and took her arm as they made their way through the hallway. She asked no questions about her sudden departure, for which Mary was grateful. She did not feel ready yet to talk about Caroline Bingley.
"Should you like to see over the house? I thought we might take the grand tour after you've had tea. I don't think you saw much of it when you were here before."
Mary had rarely seen Elizabeth as proud as when they walked together through the huge rooms, her pace quick and eager, her voice lively as she described and pointed and informed, her pleasure in her new establishment apparent in every tireless step. They viewed the sculpture gallery and the most notable family portraits. They stood at the door of the library, which was the largest Mary had ever seen, and to which Lizzie was sure Mr. Darcy would be pleased to grant her access when he returned home in a week or so. In the meantime, the sisters established a very comfortable routine. They drank their coffee in the yellow morning room and took tea in Lizzie's boudoir. They ate alone in the dining room with the Chinese wallpaper, a servant standing behind their chairs. When they needed fresh air, they strolled together through the grounds, Lizzie drawing Mary's attention to every remarkable feature, to every wood, pond, or possible improvement. Here she thought she might plant a flower garden. In this quiet corner she had an idea of establishing a school. But nothing delighted them both as much as the hours they spent in the nursery with young Fitzwilliam Darcy. He sat on Mary's lap, a sturdy toddler in a white frock, his direct, assessing stare suggesting he was already in possession of his father's determined will. It was not until their third or perhaps even their fourth encounter that he showed he had also inherited his mother's charm. He took Mary by surprise, reaching out his hands towards her with a broad, enticing grin, his fingers sticky and warm as they clasped hers, before turning back to his mother and holding up his face for a kiss. It was impossible not to laugh and smile, and Mary did both very readily.
"You seem very happy, Lizzie."
"Indeed I am. I'm not sure I deserve it, but I intend to behave as if I do. I won't apologise for the great good luck I've been granted. But in truth, Mary, I am really very grateful. I never imagined I would be so admirably suited, and although I don't choose to let everyone know it, there isn't a day when I don't give thanks that things turned out as they did. Not a single day."
Very moved, Mary reached over and touched Lizzie's hand. For an instant, Mary felt nothing for her but a rush of affection and a desire it might be returned. She knew she would never forget Lizzie's betrayal on the night of Mr. Bingley's ball. For all her attempts to excuse her sister's behaviour, she could not give it any other name, but had begun to hope that in the future relations between them might be warmer once more. Lizzie was secure and content, no longer teased and annoyed by her family, desperate to distance herself from the embarrassments they caused her. Perhaps, thought Mary, this serenity would encourage Lizzie to look more kindly upon her, to think more generously of her and her situation. If they could recover just a fraction of the pleasure they had taken in each other's company when they were young, that would be enough. Mary would not expect more. As the days rolled by, there were moments when Mary allowed herself to believe her hopes might be realised. It seemed to her that she and Lizzie had become great friends once more, perfectly at ease with each other. They were happy together, requiring no other company. They read, walked, chatted, and played with Fitzwilliam, who now knew Mary well enough to bestow upon her an occasional lordly smile. It was exactly what Mary had once longed for, and she began to feel the weight of the anxiety which burdened her imperceptibly lighten. She wondered if she felt bold enough yet to speak to Lizzie about her future, to confide in her that she did not know where she should go or what should become of her, that she quailed when she thought of the few choices open to her. Could she confess that the thought of living alongside her mother appalled her? Surely Lizzie would understand that particular horror. No one had more good sense or acute penetration. When she imagined the relief of having Lizzie as her confidant, Mary felt her spirits rise. She would tell her about Caroline Bingley and her taunts. She allowed herself a little smile as she considered how, with a single tart remark, Lizzie would take the sting from Miss Bingley's insults and make Mary see her as she really was, ridiculous, petty, and eaten up with bitterness. She felt a sense of calm sweep over her, but she did not admit, even to herself, that she had begun to wonder whether she might eventually find a home at Pemberley, whether somewhere in the great house, amidst all the statues and paintings and boudoirs and drawing rooms, there might be a place for her. Then Mr. Darcy returned. He had been in London on business, and now came home, bringing with him his sister, Georgiana, a fine-looking girl of 19. Immediately the tenor of their little party shifted. Mr. Darcy was not a demonstrative man, but his character was of such a strong and decided nature that it could not fail to impress itself very powerfully on those around him. With Lizzie and his sister, his habitual gravity was tempered by affection. To Georgiana he was a kind and indulgent brother, to Lizzie a passionately attached husband. But as the days passed, Mary saw that in her company he was never at his ease. He was always strictly polite and gentlemanly, but around her he could not unbend. It was not long before his air of detached correctness unsettled her, and she began to grow self-conscious around him. She did not know how best to raise herself in his opinion. Should she try to join the conversation, attempt a liveliness she did not feel in order to show herself a pleasant and amusing guest? Or was it better to say nothing at all, choosing instead to efface herself as much as possible in the hope of simply escaping his notice? She soon discovered that neither stratagem worked. When she was silent, she merely confirmed his opinion of her dullness. When she sought to entertain, she always struck the wrong note. Then Elizabeth would intervene, smoothing away everything with a joke or a laugh. Under Lizzie's tender, amused gaze, her husband became another man, warm, smiling, taken by surprise at his own happiness. Mary once caught a look pass between them of such intimate intensity that she dropped her eyes, as flustered as if she had come upon them alone and unawares. It was this that finally led her to understand there was nothing she could ever do to win Mr. Darcy's goodwill. It came to her in a flash that he had no desire to bridge the distance between them. He was far too well-bred to show it, but she saw with absolute clarity that he longed for her to be gone. Her presence was more than a petty irritant. It was a constraint on his desire to indulge his strongest affections as freely and as openly as he wished. Only when she had left Pemberley could he be himself again, secure amongst those he loved best, unhampered by the company of a stranger at his table, of an awkward guest in the breakfast room, on the terrace, in the nursery, anywhere, in fact, where he wished to be alone with his wife. Mary felt the truth of this revelation with an almost physical pain, certain that her happy days at Pemberley were numbered. She did not think her welcome would long survive Mr. Darcy's impatience with her. Indeed, it was painfully apparent that Lizzie had already drifted away from her, preferring to spend her time with her husband rather than her sister, and when he was occupied with business and unavailable to her, Georgiana was always with them. Mary rarely saw Lizzie alone now. The companionable hours they had enjoyed together when she first arrived were not repeated. Now it was Georgiana who walked arm in arm with Lizzie, Mary following a few steps behind. Georgiana Darcy was a timid, watchful girl, somewhat in awe of her brother, and plainly delighted to have discovered in Elizabeth such an agreeable and sympathetic friend. Mary often caught her looking at Lizzie with frank adoration, and saw too that her feelings were returned, that Lizzie enveloped her in all the warm affection Mary had hoped might one day be directed towards herself. It was sometimes hard for Mary to watch as her sister coaxed Georgiana delicately out of her shell, encouraging her to think better of herself and not to be afraid of displaying her talents. In the afternoons, they sat in the drawing-room as Georgiana practised at the piano. Her slender figure shone to advantage as she leant over the keyboard, her pale hands extended in scales and arpeggios. Mary was compelled to admit she played well. So well, in fact, that she did not dare approach the piano herself, unwilling to suffer by comparison. She tried to banish jealous thoughts, but it hurt to watch Lizzie offering Georgiana all the praise she had once yearned to receive herself. Lizzie never asked Mary to play. Instead, at the end of a particularly demanding piece from Georgiana, Lizzie applauded loudly and turned to Mary, her face shining and delighted.
Wasn't that fine? Don't you think she's extraordinarily good? Have you ever heard anything better done?
Mary shook her head. No, I do not think I have. Well done, Georgiana. Her face faintly flushed from exertion. Georgiana smiled briefly towards Mary before rushing to sit at Elizabeth's side, the better to enjoy her approbation. Georgiana did not speak to Mary, but she rarely did. Her silence was in part a product of her shyness, but Mary suspected there was more to it than that. Sometimes she caught Georgiana observing her with a mild, puzzled surprise.
"What exactly are you doing here?" she seemed to ask. "However did this happen? And how long do you mean to stay?" There was no malice in her curiosity, just a faint whiff of bemusement.
As Mary watched Georgiana engage Lizzie in cheerful conversation, in which it was clear she could have no part, she began to ask herself the same questions. Later that evening, resting on her bed before dinner, already dressed but conscious it was too early to go down, Mary heard the sound of one of her favourite sonatas coming from the piano below. She would have known Lizzie's style anywhere, bold and blithely indifferent to the odd false note. She sat up. As the sonata came to an end, she heard laughter, voices raised in pleasure. There was a pause, then a new piece began, played with a delicacy that could only be Georgiana's. Quietly, she stole downstairs and stood outside the door, listening. No one looked towards her. There was Georgiana, intent at the keyboard, her expression rapt. There was Mr. Darcy standing at her side, turning the pages of the music, smiling as he never did when Mary was near. And there too was Lizzie, her hand draped over her husband's arm, looking up at him with transparent affection, whilst their little son played at their feet, banging his toys in a rhythm that did not entirely complement the beauty of the song. The foursome was as perfectly composed as a painting, handsome, charming, and entirely self-contained. Georgiana finished the piece with a flourish. Mr. Darcy proudly patted her shoulder, whilst Lizzie clapped her hands. Mary closed her eyes and turned away. It was impossible for her to go in and join them. Her presence would only break the spell. In that moment, Mary understood that whilst she would never be treated harshly at Pemberley, there were other ways of being made to understand you were not required. Mr. Darcy would never warm to her. He might tolerate her for Elizabeth's sake, but in his eyes, she would always be the worst possible version of herself, gauche, clumsy, and dull. Georgiana's situation was very different. She would never be a guest to be endured on sufferance. She was family, loved by both her brother and Lizzie, always welcome to make her home with them. If there was a place at Pemberley for an unmarried sister, Mary knew, as she watched the little group around the piano, it was not for her. She did not belong in these elegant rooms, amongst these beautiful people. They had each other, and that was enough. When Mary told her sister she intended to leave Pemberley, Elizabeth had not entirely understood the reasons for her decision, but did not press her too hard for an explanation. Perhaps she too had begun to sense Mr. Darcy's irritation with Mary's presence, and forced to decide between preserving the comfort of a beloved husband and her duty to an awkward sister, she did not protest very convincingly when Mary announced her departure. Mary's proposed destination, however, surprised her. She found it hard to believe she intended to visit Longbourn.
"But why should you want to go there? It must be full of so many painful associations."
Mary did not choose to explain that her present circumstances were hardly conducive to happiness, nor to confess that she could think of nowhere else to go.
I think I should like to be somewhere familiar again, to be surrounded by places I know. I hope I might find it consoling.
Really? It seems a strange way of seeking solace. Won't it distress you to see the Collinses established in our old home? I'm not sure I'd want to see Mr. Collins at his ease in our father's library, or Charlotte presiding over our mother's tea table.
Yes, I don't doubt that will be difficult, but I'll be able to walk in the woods and sit in the garden. I can read Papa's books, and Charlotte could not have urged me more eagerly to come.
Lizzie said no more. Mary was too tactful to add that the prospect of seeing Charlotte had in fact been one of the principal inducements which had driven her to beg an invitation to Longbourn. She was desperate to discuss her unhappy state with someone. She understood now that neither Jane nor Lizzie could help her. Securely settled with men they loved, they could have no understanding of her fears. Charlotte, however, was a different matter, for she knew what it was to feel hopeless and alone. Mary had not always found her advice palatable or agreed with her conclusions, but she longed to talk to someone who had once shared her predicament. Perhaps the ideas that had so shocked her when Charlotte first confessed them might not seem so dreadful now. The experience of the last 2 years had certainly helped her understand why Charlotte had embraced them so determinedly, and in her secret heart, Mary hoped that her stay at Longbourn would result in something more than guidance. She longed to find out whether Charlotte had been right when she insisted a marriage founded on self-interest rather than love stood as good a chance as most unions of turning out well. Were Charlotte and Mr. Collins happy? And if so, should Mary make up her mind to follow Charlotte's example? But she said none of this to Lizzie.
Chapter 34. As the carriage jolted along on the final approach to the house, Mary felt her whole body tense. When they cleared the trees, she would see Longbourn again. Then, as the familiar outline came into view, she gasped. She could not help herself, and leant forward keenly to take it all in. At first glance, everything seemed as it had always been, the house sitting with its usual confidence in its small park. But as she drew nearer, Mary saw that Longbourn presented a far smarter face to the world than it had done when the Bennets occupied it. The gravel drive was swept and weeded, the window frames neatly restored, and the front door painted a deep and lustrous black. Yet there was no time for her to absorb these changes before the door was flung open and the lady of the house appeared. As Mary climbed down from the carriage, it rushed into her mind that she must not forget to call Charlotte Mrs. Collins. But before she knew it, she found herself kissing Charlotte's cheek, her arm taken firmly as she was led into the house which, until so recently, had been her home. In the drawing room, sitting down to tea, they were formal with each other at first. Inquiries were made into the health of the Bingleys, the state of Mrs. Bennet's nerves, and the well-being of the Darcy family. Mary confirmed she had left them all in good spirits. Elizabeth particularly asked to be remembered to you. Charlotte smiled politely. I'm very glad to hear she's happy, though it must be difficult not to be so, established as she is. Yes, she has been very fortunate. I think she knows it and is thankful. Charlotte inclined her head but said nothing more. The affection between Charlotte and Lizzie had never recovered from the blow dealt to it by Lizzie's horrified response to Charlotte's acceptance of Mr. Collins's proposal. Charlotte was not easily disconcerted, but she had not forgotten the shame she had felt as Lizzie stared at her with frank disbelief, unable to credit that any woman of sense could consider such a man as a suitor. Charlotte had been glad when Lizzie married and moved away to Derbyshire, and had steadfastly refused Mr. Collins's entreaties to solicit an invitation to Pemberley. When asked to attend the celebrations for young Fitzwilliam's christening, she had declined. She suspected Elizabeth had not changed her opinion of either her marriage or her husband, and did not care to be reminded of either by her disapproval or pity. The friendship that had sustained them for so many years had withered little by little, until nothing was left of it
but the occasional exchange of mild civilities. Charlotte leant across the table and poured more tea into Mary's cup. Mary was struck by her air of prosperity and self-possession. She was carefully dressed, in clothes that bespoke quality rather than the first fashion, but their rich sobriety suited her. Along with her new wardrobe, Charlotte had acquired an air of easy authority that had not been noticeable when she was merely Miss Lucas, an unmarried woman fast approaching the perils of her 30s with no suitor in view.
"I see you have put on your cap, Charlotte, as you always said you would."
Charlotte laughed.
"Yes, I believe I once told you I should do so, one way or another. But I must admit, it gives me far more pleasure to wear it as a wife than as an old maid."
Mary flinched a little. These were not words she liked to hear, but Charlotte did not seem to notice.
"Mr. Collins apologizes that he is not here to join me in welcoming you. He has business in Hartford, but if he is not too much detained, he will join us for dinner."
She leant back in her chair and fixed Mary with a steady, assessing gaze.
"And what of yourself, Mary? Tell me how things are with you. Mr. Collins and I were both delighted to receive your letter. You know, I hope, that you will always be welcome at Longbourn, whenever you choose to visit us. May I offer you some sugar?"
Mary shook her head.
"But I confess I was also a little surprised. We had imagined you happily settled with Jane or Elizabeth." "Yes, both have been very generous. Indeed, all my sisters have been most solicitous. Jane says I may always stay with her. Kitty asked me to join her at the rectory, and even Lydia, well, that would hardly suit, but it was a kindness in her to ask."
"And did none of these possibilities appeal?" Mary felt apprehension rise up within her. Part of her wanted to throw off her bonnet and cry, "No, no, none of them will work. They will all grow tired of me, and then what will I do? Tell me."
But she was not ready to confess her deepest fears to a young woman who seemed altogether more commanding and less vulnerable than the Charlotte she remembered. Flustered, she pulled her glasses from her pocket and began to twist them in her hands.
"I think it would be a great fault in me to make so important a decision as my place of habitation without allowing time for proper reflection. I have many important considerations to consider, and it is rightly said that those who make judgments in haste will repent in leisure."
Charlotte smiled a brisk little smile.
"Indeed it is. Well, I hope you will find your stay here conducive to such serious thinking. I shall certainly do all I can to make it so. Now, if you don't think it will distress you, I wonder if you would like to see over the house before resting. We have made a number of improvements since we arrived. I should very much like to hear your opinion of them."
For the first time, Mary looked properly around her. She had been so intent on mastering her own feelings that she had barely registered her surroundings. The drawing room had been quite transformed. The sofas were newly covered, the walls distempered, and the floor sanded. At the windows hung curtains of dark figured velvet. As Mary contemplated their splendour, Charlotte looked on with deep satisfaction.
"They look very well, don't they? I bought them at the sale when the Collingwoods sold up. There's a little woman in Meryton who can do anything with a needle. She cut them down for me. I was in agonies when she wielded the scissors, but I own I'm delighted with the result."
Mary nodded obligingly and followed Charlotte as she marched down the old, familiar passages. It was unsettling to be shown around a house where she had lived for so long as if she were a stranger, and the sight of so many well-remembered objects and places brought a lump to her throat. There on the landing stood the long clock, exiled from the drawing room after Lydia's shoe, thrown in a passion at Kitty, had cracked its glass and stopped its pendulum. There was the little table in whose drawer her mother had kept her needles, wrapped up in a silk bag that always smelled of camphor. Everywhere she looked, something recalled the past with such force that Mary was almost overpowered by sadness and regret. But she kept her polite smile in place and did nothing to halt the flow of her guide's enthusiasm. Charlotte's initial consideration for Mary's feelings had quickly evaporated, her delicacy entirely eclipsed by her pride in her home. Mary was led into every room and urged to admire it, encouraged to inspect every new-built cupboard and every blackened fire grate. She did so without complaint, until she had exhausted every word of praise and approval at her command. Finally, she could think of nothing more to say than that the house even smelled very fresh and sweet.
"I have a floor polish made to my own recipe, flavoured with oil of lavender. It is these little touches that make such a difference," Charlotte said, as she looked around her, entirely satisfied with her domain and confident it had been displayed to the very best advantage. "But now I should like to show you my greatest achievement. I think he will be awake now."
In the nursery, Mary's heart missed a beat as she took a seat near the fire where she and Elizabeth had once sat, books in hand, making out her letters. Now she was introduced to the room's new owner. William Collins was a stocky, fair-haired toddler who, when released from his mother's hugs, stared curiously at Mary from the safety of her lap. "He is a very fine child," declared Mary. "You know, he looks at me in exactly the same way as Lizzie's son, the same frank and interested look. You must be very proud of him."
"Oh, yes. In my opinion, he is a prodigy amongst boys. And, of course, he is somewhat older than Fitzwilliam. I imagine William is much further on. He must be taller, more forward. He even talks a little."
Charlotte stroked her son's downy head, as delighted by her child as she was by her house.
"He is a very remarkable child. Everyone says so."
It was almost dark by the time Mary was released to rest for a while before dinner.
"I'm sure I don't need to show you to your room,"
declared Charlotte, as she made her way to the kitchen to ensure all was in order there. "You will hardly have forgotten where to find it." As she pushed open the door, Mary saw that a few candles were already lit and that her bag was open on the bed. At her dressing table stood Mrs. Hill, who was calmly unpacking her brushes and unfolding her clothes, as if they had seen each other only yesterday.
"Mrs. Hill, I am so very pleased to see you."
"As I am to see you, Miss Mary. It has been a long time since we last spoke."
"I hope all is well with you and Mr. Hill."
"Yes, thank you. It was a great relief to us when Mrs. Collins decided to keep us on. I should have been very sad to leave Longbourn."
"I understand that only too well."
"Of course, it is different with all of you gone. It will never be the same without your poor father, and Mrs. Collins is very exacting, but we rub along together quite happily."
For a while, Mary answered inquiries about the health of her mother and sisters, receiving in return all the limited news that Meryton could supply. At first, Mrs. Hill asked no difficult questions. It was only when she began to hang up Mary's clothes that she betrayed a curiosity about Mary's situation.
"Is this what you wore at Pemberley, miss?"
"Yes, we were just family whilst I was there. No formality at all."
"But for evenings you must have had something smarter to put on. Did you not choose to bring it with you?"
"I left my better things there, so as not to give trouble. So much packing and unpacking."
She looked away, trying not to meet Mrs. Hill's sceptical eye.
"And we are told not to think too much of our appearance. The sin of pride, you know."
"What about the dress you wore to the Meryton ball? I always thought that looked very well on you. It seems a pity not to have it with you."
"I'm afraid it is a very long time since I have had occasion to wear it. But if I had known Longbourn had become so grand, I should certainly have given it an airing."
Mrs. Hill looked about to ask more, then instead confined herself to observing that those dresses Mary had brought would be improved by a little care and attention, and that with her help, Mary would cut as credible a figure as was possible with such outfits. Chapter 35. By the time Mary walked into the dining room, Charlotte was already in place, presiding at the top of the table. She seemed even smarter and more sleek than she had done in daylight, straight-backed and assured, head held high. She fitted effortlessly into her surroundings, a perfect complement to the glowing furniture and newly gilded mirrors, the last piece of a jigsaw that completed a picture of domestic order and content. To her surprise, Mary found herself faintly in awe of this new version of her old acquaintance. In a few years, Charlotte would be an imposing figure. By the time she was 40, she would be quite formidable.
"I do not know what is keeping Mr. Collins," Charlotte remarked. "He is usually a most punctilious timekeeper."
The two women were drinking their first glass of wine by the time Mr. Collins came hurrying into the room.
"My dear Miss Bennet, how can I apologize enough? I was detained by the bishop, and it was not in my power to leave. It was most unfortunate, but as I'm sure you'll agree, our personal inclinations must always give way to the duties owed to superior rank."
Charlotte signalled to a servant to fill Mr. Collins's glass. Her husband was flustered, put at a disadvantage by his late arrival.
I regret to say, Mrs. Collins, that I might have been a little earlier had I not been incommoded by the absence of a few necessities in my dressing room. The clean neckcloths were not where I have become used to finding them."
"I am sorry to hear it," replied his wife evenly. "I will speak to Mrs. Hill, but I'm glad to see you are suitably attired now, and no doubt ready to greet our old friend." Mollified, Mr. Collins turned to Mary with a broad, accommodating smile.
"You are most welcome, Miss Bennet. I will not say to our home, as that might seem a painful allusion to a house that was so recently your own place of residence, and might have remained so had circumstances been different. But man proposes, God disposes, as is most justly said. I hope that gives you some comfort."
"Why, yes, sir," Mary replied. "We are all of us subject to the caprices of fortune." "Mary has just returned from a long visit to Pemberley," volunteered Charlotte smoothly. "I'm sure you will want to hear how she found everyone there." As Mary recounted the particulars of her stay in Derbyshire, the air of awkwardness around the table began to dissipate, helped by the excellent red wine which Charlotte ensured was in generous supply. Mr. Collins listened with every appearance of interest to all Mary could tell him about the various livings held by Mr. Darcy and the parsonage houses attached to them. Once he understood that few of them produced tithes equal to those he himself enjoyed, he grew increasingly affable. Charlotte said little, but Mary noticed she was assiduous in ensuring that every dish reached his end of the table before her husband asked for it. The food was plentiful, and of a far higher quality than Mary recalled had been served at Lucas Lodge.
"May I compliment you on the dinner, Charlotte? It really is very good."
"Thank you, Mary.
I was determined to do all I could to maintain the reputation Longbourn had always enjoyed for the excellence of its cooking. I'm very pleased if you think I've succeeded."
Warmed up and calmed down with a few grilled soles and a leg of lamb, Mr. Collins turned a benevolent face towards his wife.
"My dear Charlotte is an excellent manager. As you will have seen for yourself, everything at Longbourn bespeaks taste and comfort, and always in a style appropriate to the station in which Providence has been pleased to place us."
Charlotte did not meet Mr. Collins's fond smile, but dropped her eyes to her plate. When he reached across to pat her hand, she did not respond. His hand lingered above hers for only a moment before he withdrew it, busying himself with the dessert and asking Mary whether Mr. Darcy had put up any pheasants in his park. For the rest of the meal, Charlotte was all attentiveness, helping Mr. Collins to the ripest slice of cheese or the choicest piece of fruit. But it seemed to Mary as if there was a coolness in her solicitude. Perhaps they were merely tired. Mary felt herself to be on the edge of exhaustion, and was relieved when Charlotte finally rose from the table, firmly conveying that supper was over.
"Mr. Collins, Mary and I will leave you to finish your wine. She has had a long journey, and I'm sure she's in great need of sleep, although she is far too polite to show it."
As they left, Mary glanced behind her. The room shimmered in the candlelight, glowing with warmth and prosperity. At the table, Mr. Collins sat alone, cracking nuts with solitary concentration, as he poured himself another glass of wine. A little later, Mary lay in the dark of her old room, comforted to find that although the bed had new hangings, the springs of the mattress still creaked in the way she remembered. As she stared up at the freshly painted ceiling, she reflected on what had been a most extraordinary day. Revisiting the house had not proved as painful as she had expected, although there were moments when she found herself almost unbearably moved, as some small corner or chance encounter brought back to her such a strong sense of the past that it almost overwhelmed her. This had happened less often than she had feared. Charlotte's improvements had scrubbed away so much that was familiar about Longbourn as she had known it, had so efficiently erased the life the Bennets had lived there, that little remained to prompt regret for what had gone. Charlotte herself had proved almost as transformed as the house. It seemed to Mary as if Charlotte had grown in every way, in confidence, stature, and self-possession. The word that best described her, Mary thought, with all its connotations of order and security, was established. Watching her as she managed the little empire of her household and garden, as she hugged her child and marshalled her servants, as she transformed the appearance of Longbourn into a vision of her own imagining, it was impossible not to believe she had found the place in the world she had always longed for. Judged on those terms, it seemed impossible to argue with the bargain Charlotte had made when she married. But as Mary finally drifted off to sleep, she remembered Charlotte's refusal to meet her husband's eyes, the bleak impression of Mr. Collins staring into his wine as she and Charlotte left the room. They cast a shadow over the rosy glow of her first impressions. Mary pushed them to the back of her mind. Rational observation, not the unreliable promptings of emotion, should be her guide. Reason would conclude whether Charlotte's choice had been correct, and whether it was one she might consider adopting for herself. Chapter 36. In the weeks that followed, Mary's days took on a pattern that suited her very well. She breakfasted in her room, staying aloof from the early morning bustle of the family, joining Charlotte only when the floors were swept, young William fed, and that night's dinner ordered. When everyone else was busy, she sat at the old familiar piano and played for as long as her fingers would allow. At Longbourn, there was neither competition for a seat at the keyboard, nor any risk she would be mortified by the superior skills of another. In the afternoons, she tried to be useful, following Charlotte into the garden in a borrowed apron, pruning knife in hand. Sometimes she carried a basket to the poultry yard to gather eggs. Each day was perfectly uneventful, and slowly the despair that had come upon her in Derbyshire began to lose the sharp edge of its pain. Now it was a dull ache of sadness, which she resolved to conquer if she could. At the dinner table, she forced herself not to think of how it had looked when she and her sisters crowded around it, and when she saw Charlotte sewing in her mother's chair, sitting exactly as Mrs. Bennet had done in order to catch the light, she compelled herself not to turn away. But for all of her determination to accustom herself to the new order of things, she still felt a pang of grief when she walked past her father's library, which she had not yet had the courage to enter. And she declined to accompany Charlotte on social visits, knowing herself not yet ready to brave the curiosity of her old neighbours, who would demand to know, with no sense of delicacy, what she intended to do, where she planned to go. As she had no answer to give, she preferred to avoid all such encounters whenever she could. Still, in general, she found the steady routine of life at Longbourn congenial enough. No one harassed or teased her, and she never felt exposed or out of place. Charlotte was solicitous but not overbearing, and Mary began to enjoy her company. It was some time before it occurred to her just how much of Charlotte's time was available to her. One afternoon, as they were cutting the last of the tulips to take into the house, it struck Mary how rarely they encountered Mr. Collins, and how very little time he and his wife spent together. "I imagine," she asked tentatively, "that Mr. Collins is very occupied with business during the day." "He certainly has a great deal to do," replied Charlotte. "The time of a clergyman can scarcely be called his own. But even when he is at leisure, he rarely joins us here or walks with us in the evenings. Does he like to be so solitary?" "I do not think he minds it. He is at present very taken up with making a little arbour near the orchard. It was a suggestion of mine he has quite seized upon. He is doing much of the work himself, which is most beneficial for his health. I hope to have a seat placed there when it is finished. Should you like to go and help him, Charlotte? I am very happy to continue here alone. Charlotte reached out and grasped a particularly fine bloom, snipping it briskly through the stem. No, thank you, Mary. I am very well where I am. We shall all meet again for dinner soon enough. Seeing there was no more to be said, Mary put down her scissors, gathered her flowers into an orderly bunch, and began to walk back to the house. As she rounded the yew hedge, she caught sight of Mr. Collins in the distance. With his coat off and his shirt sleeves rolled up, he was digging at the ground with a furious intensity. She watched him until he threw down the spade and, wiping his brow with his sleeve, leant disconsolately against the garden wall. He did not look happy. Mary turned away abruptly, keen he should not see her. It was an unsettling encounter. She felt almost as though she had intruded on some private grief. Over the next few nights, she watched her hosts with a new awareness. Charlotte was as unruffled as ever, smilingly deferential to her husband. But the more Mary studied him, the more uneasy Mr. Collins seemed. Mary saw how often he tried to catch Charlotte's eye or to engage her in conversation, and how, with every appearance of politeness, she always avoided him. Eventually, disheartened, he said no more but looked away in silence. Mary had no doubt now of his state of mind. She was too familiar with the experience of misery not to recognize its familiar marks on another. But what, she asked herself, had Mr. Collins to be unhappy about? He had a comfortable home, the wife he had wanted, and a healthy son in the nursery. What could have lowered his spirits to such a degree? It was true Charlotte was not the most demonstrative of spouses, and did not seem much given to public displays of affection, but she always showed the utmost consideration for his wishes, and no hint of irritation or ill-temper ever escaped her lips. Mary's own parents had not always lived well together, but the causes of their dissatisfaction had been easy to understand and all too forcefully expressed. Whatever troubled Mr. Collins was not nearly so apparent. Perhaps it had nothing to do with his circumstances. Perhaps his character had a disposition to melancholy. Even in her limited experience of life, she had observed that some people were miserable in the midst of prosperity, whilst others remained cheerful in even the harshest of conditions. Lydia, for example, was never really cast down, even though her circumstances could hardly be described as easy. Whereas she herself, she did not like to complete that thought, preferring instead to ask herself the question in more abstract terms. How, she mused, are we to understand happiness and the ways in which it is brought about? Is it determined by inherited temperament? Or is it all a matter of chance, a quality arbitrarily bestowed on some, but not on others? Do our circumstances matter? Are beauty and wealth more likely to produce happiness than goodness and self-sacrifice? And is there anything an individual can do to improve their own sense of contentment and satisfaction? As Mary considered these questions, it occurred to her that she might usefully pursue them further. It had been some time since she had applied her mind to a weighty intellectual question, and this one seemed especially suited to her current circumstances. Her father's library was particularly well provided with the philosophical works she would require, and there were no other calls on her time to distract her. Besides, she felt ready to exercise her reason again, to pit it against a challenge which would call on all her resources of concentration and effort. She did not deny that there was also a more personal application to such a study. An exploration of the nature of happiness could add to her understanding of her own situation, and might even counter her own strong tendency to despair. The following afternoon, as Charlotte stood in the hall, tying on her hat in preparation for a visit to Lady Lucas, Mary asked if she might have permission to spend a few hours in the library whilst she was gone. Young William gambolled about their feet, banging his favourite toy on the stairs. Charlotte scooped him up, laughing. I cannot imagine why the peace of that comfortable room could possibly be preferred to an afternoon with my mother and this monster of a boy. But really, there's no need to ask. Please make use of it whenever you choose. By the time the front door closed, Mary was already inside the library. For a moment, she stood quite still, surveying the room where she had spent so many hours. There was her father's desk, cleared now of his books and the muddle of papers that had always covered it. What had he been reading whilst he sat there, inscrutable, amused by some secret joke, and unreachable to everyone but Lizzie? Mary would never understand now what this place had meant to him, and how he occupied his mind within it. She walked with as much self-possession as she could muster to the bookshelves. It felt strange to search them without feeling his eyes upon her, no longer apprehensive that she would irritate him by taking too long or making too much noise. She moved amongst the shelves with a quiet, determined freedom until she finally found what she wanted. Then she sat at the table she had always used and began to turn the pages of her book. Chapter 37. At first, Mary had the library entirely to herself. She arrived in the middle of the morning, established herself in her place, and did not leave it until required to dress for dinner. Soon she became used to her solitude, and even began to relish it. She was therefore caught completely by surprise when one afternoon Mr. Collins burst in unannounced, carrying a large sheaf of papers with the evident intention of working there himself. He had thrown his bundle onto the desk and had sat down heavily in her father's old chair before he noticed Mary at the far end of the room.
"Oh, my dear Miss Bennet, I did not know you were here. I cannot apologise enough for my unmannerly intrusion. I will withdraw immediately."
Mary stood up, embarrassed.
"No, sir, it is I who am at fault. This is your room, and I am a sad trespasser in it. Mrs. Collins gave me to understand it would not be required by you for some time. I should never have settled myself here if I had known you had business to attend to."
More mutual apologies were offered and declined, and eventually it was decided that Mary should remain where she was, and that her presence should not in the least bother Mr. Collins or incommode him in any way, and that he would hold himself in readiness to depart at the least hint from her that she wished him gone. As Mary had no desire to expel him from his own study, soon no more was heard but the scratching of his pen and the turning of her pages, until Mr. Collins excused himself and bid her a polite farewell. When Mary herself eventually gathered up her books and left to go and dress, she met Charlotte in the hall.
"I'm so sorry to hear your studies were broken in upon by Mr. Collins earlier today. I know he's very sorry to have disturbed you. Shall I ask him to work elsewhere? He could use the little parlour. No one goes there in the afternoons. Please do not do so on my behalf. It is his library, after all. But perhaps if my presence does not annoy him, I could continue to study at the far end of the room. I have all my books laid out and am comfortably established there. I promise I will do nothing to irritate him." "I doubt very much whether any irritation or annoyance would come from you," replied Charlotte briskly. "I'm sure that scheme will work very well. I shall suggest to Mr. Collins that you become joint occupants of the library, each with your own well-defined and separate territories. It is a plan I find answers admirably in many circumstances, so I see no reason why it should not do so in this case." Upstairs in her room, as Mrs. Hill did her hair, Mary's thoughts wandered back to Charlotte's words. The calming rhythm of the brush and the companionable silence that surrounded them encouraged her to ask a question directly, which she might otherwise have hesitated to broach at all. "Mrs. Hill, do you think that Mr. and Mrs. Collins are well matched?"
Still brushing, Mrs. Hill considered.
"Well, as well as most, I'd say. They don't argue, and there's never any trouble between them."
"Yes, but do they like each other? Do they enjoy each other's company?"
"I can tell you've never been married, Miss Mary. They've been together for a few years. You can't expect them to behave like young lovers."
That was not what Mary had seen at Pemberley. Lizzie and Mr. Darcy's wedding had taken place not long after that of Mr. and Mrs. Collins, but time had done nothing to dampen the strength of the affection they felt for each other. Even Mary, with no experience of the workings of the heart, could not fail to recognise the pleasure they took in each other's company. No one's presence delighted her husband more than Lizzie's, and her face lit up with happiness every time he entered the room. But things were very different at Longbourn. Here Mary had seen no loving glances exchanged, no cheerful contentment, no desire to spend as much time as possible with each other. On the contrary, it struck Mary that whilst the Darcys were rarely apart, Mr. and Mrs. Collins were hardly ever together. Of course, it could not be denied that Charlotte had much to occupy her. There was her boy to look after, and her household to manage, with far less assistance than Lizzie could call upon. And once those duties were fulfilled, the improvements to the house absorbed what little leisure remained to her. It seemed there was always something that demanded Charlotte's attention, calling her away from her husband, preventing her from accompanying him on outings or sharing any small pleasures with him. Then there was the little arbour, which took up so many of Mr. Collins's spare hours. Mary had begun to wonder whether Charlotte had requested its construction with the sole intention of its absorbing her husband's energies and putting as much distance as possible between himself and her. This was an ungenerous thought, and Mary sought to repress it. But the more she saw how their lives were ordered, the harder it was to ignore the possibility that Charlotte had deliberately arranged her time so that she spent as little of it as possible in the company of her husband. In the mirror, Mary watched as Mrs. Hill secured her neat bun in place. They seem to be apart for much of the day.
Well, there are many different ways to make a marriage work, and if that's the one they've chosen, it's not up to any of us to ask why.
But what if one of them didn't choose it? Mrs. Hill sighed.
Then they won't be the first to have found matrimony not quite what they'd expected, and they'll have to make the best of it. There you are, Miss Mary. You're quite done.
At dinner, Mary felt ashamed of herself as she watched Charlotte minister efficiently to Mr. Collins's every need. Her curiosity seemed poor recompense for Charlotte's hospitality. Surely it was ungrateful, distasteful even, to speculate about the private concerns of her hosts in this way. But the more she observed them together, the more she was convinced of the gulf that lay between them. And also, and perhaps more surprisingly, that for all her polite attentions, it was Charlotte who was the architect of it. Behind her mild, compliant demeanour, she was entirely self-contained. Nothing Mr. Collins said or did touched her. Her feelings were locked up and battened down, in every way inaccessible to her husband. As Mary stole a glance at Mr. Collins's bleak, resigned expression, she realised that he knew this, and that the unhappiness she sensed in him was the result of this knowledge. Mary could not sleep that night, disturbed by what she had seen. When she first arrived at Longbourn, she had assumed the success of the Collins marriage could be judged by Charlotte's sentiments alone. It had not occurred to her to consider Mr. Collins's feelings in the matter. He had achieved his ambition of finding a respectable woman willing to marry him. Surely that was enough. What more could he have hoped for? It was not possible he had expected love. Mary had not considered him capable of deep emotion, but she now saw she had been mistaken. Charlotte had made whatever accommodations had been necessary to resign herself to a marriage of convenience and, superficially at least, was content. It was her husband who was left miserable in an arrangement of his own making.
Chapter 38. Mary was working in the library one morning, enjoying her solitary state. Then, just as she had decided he did not intend to join her there, Mr. Collins appeared at the door with a self-conscious air.
Miss Bennet, I understand from Mrs. Collins that it will not inconvenience you if I work for a few hours at my desk. Oh, please tell me if that is so. If not, I will depart at once.
Mary assured him, as she had done before, that she would be very agreeable to their sharing the room, and eventually he sat down and began to shuffle his papers. Mary applied herself to her books and was soon so thoroughly engaged with them that the next sound she heard was Charlotte calling them both to tea. As he readied himself to leave, Mr. Collins beamed at Mary with relief.
I am most grateful to you, Miss Bennet. I was not at all disturbed. You were so quiet, it was as though there was no person in the room but myself.
I am glad to have been so negligible a presence, sir. His face fell.
I did not mean to sound ungracious, but very few people understand the importance of silence as an aid to concentration. It is an essential requirement for anyone wishing to undertake serious study, but seldom found, I'm afraid to say, especially amongst the fairer sex. You, however, do not seem much given to idle and unreflecting chatter.
I'm glad to hear it, sir. It is true. I do not have much of a gift for polite conversation.
Discomfited, Mr. Collins gave a little laugh and hurried away. He was clearly satisfied with their arrangement, though, for the next day and the days following, he arrived in the library every morning, saying little, working his way diligently through his correspondence. But on the fourth day, after an hour or two had passed, Mary was surprised to see him approach her little table.
"I'm afraid my curiosity has triumphed over my manners. May I ask, Miss Bennet, what you are reading with such assiduity?"
Mary looked up, surprised. She had never supposed it would be he who broke the silence.
"Well, I'm looking into works I enjoyed when I lived here, books I found profitable and useful."
"You are reminding yourself of past pleasures, then? To a thinking mind, there is no better recreation."
"Partly, that is so, but I'm also engaged in an exercise, an investigation, if you like."
His incredulity registered plainly on his face.
"Really? Is it of a scholarly nature? If so, perhaps I may be able to assist. I am always at the disposal of any seeker after knowledge, ready to guide the uncertain tastes of those as yet unacquainted with works of a serious complexion."
Mary was not used to discussing her intellectual pursuits with anyone, and her first instinct was to retreat. But his condescension irked her. She held up her head and looked him in the eye with more boldness than was usual.
"I am interested in human happiness, sir, in the better understanding of what it is and how it may be achieved. I wish to explore whether it is a state which arises from the chance convergence of circumstances, or whether it is a condition we may will ourselves to possess. I want to understand how we may recognize it when it is within our grasp, and in what ways we can learn to live without it if we are not lucky enough to experience it."
Mr. Collins was clearly very much taken aback.
"Well, that is an extraordinary occupation for a young lady. I never suspected your interests were so philosophical. I confess, I imagined you were secretly reading novels, ashamed to be seen so frivolously engaged."
"I should not be afraid to acknowledge any book I thought worthy of my time and application, though it is true I am no great reader of fiction. I find works of fact more congenial to my mind."
"Do you indeed?"
Mr. Collins sat down and reached towards the little hoard of books piled on the table.
"May I see in which direction your tastes incline?"
He picked them up, one by one, examining their titles.
"Locke, Paley, Rousseau, even Mr. Hume. You venture into some unexpected places, Miss Bennet. Did your father know you were reading such works?"
"He may have done, but I don't think he was very interested in anyone's studies other than his own."
Mr. Collins fingered his clerical collar.
"I am surprised he had such books upon his shelves at all. They suggest a mind not wholly satisfied by Christian teaching. I should be sorry to think that that was the case, but even more grieved to learn that you yourself had been influenced by them."
"Oh, no. My faith is too firmly grounded to be shaken in the way you describe. And I cannot agree that it was wrong in my father to possess such books, or to allow anyone who wished to read them. Even Dr. Fordyce says it is desirable for our minds to be challenged, for only thus can we learn to distinguish good arguments from bad.
You put your case most forcefully, Miss Bennet. And this inquiry of yours, this study in human happiness, may I ask if it is a purely intellectual pursuit, or does it have perhaps a more personal application?
Mary had not expected such a penetrating question. I suppose all inquiry is a mixture of the intellectual and the personal. How can we know where one begins and the other ends? And surely the search for happiness, for individual happiness, is one that concerns us all, does it not? This time it was Mr. Collins who looked away.
Some might say so. I shall consider of it, Miss Bennet.
He nodded, turned on his heel, and left her alone in the library. For a while, she stared out the window, reflecting on their conversation. Then she opened the largest and most challenging volume from the books before her, put on her glasses, and began to read. Chapter 39. Mary was not sure whether Mr. Collins would return to the library whilst she worked there. She was conscious of having ventured rather too closely towards a painful truth, and thought he might not choose to share her company again. But the next day he arrived at his usual hour. He did not speak, and nothing disturbed the silence of the library until he withdrew a few hours later. The day after was the same, and the one after that. It was not until the third morning that he cleared his throat and approached her table with a book in his hand.
Miss Bennet, I have been giving some thought to our recent discussion, and after much consideration, I have decided I should not be wrong in offering this small volume to you. I think you will find it very illuminating. It is The Ethics of Aristotle. Do you know it?
Mary shook her head. He sat down and pushed the book towards her.
I think you will find it pertinent to your study. Aristotle has a great deal to say about happiness, all of it interesting, and although he did not have the benefit of hearing the word of God himself, many Christian thinkers value him highly. For that reason, I feel quite easy presenting it to you.
Tentatively, Mary picked it up.
I suggest you read a little every day to accustom yourself to his style. At the end of the week, we shall talk about what you have learned. I have a feeling you will enjoy it.
He returned to his desk and bowed his head over his papers. Mary stayed just long enough for her departure not to appear ill-mannered before hurrying to her bedroom, where she could examine the book in private. As she did so, she felt her heart beating fast. For as long as she could remember, she had longed for someone to interest themselves in her studies. That it should be Mr. Collins, of all people, who showed the first hint of curiosity in her intellectual pursuits, was astounding to her. He had been insensible to all her overtures when he first arrived at Longbourn, indifferent to every attempt of hers to engage him in her interests. But these were old wounds now, and whilst they sometimes throbbed a little to remind her of their existence, they had been succeeded by so much later pain that they no longer hurt as they once did. Now she felt nothing but gratitude that he should have chosen a book for her to read, as she opened it eagerly and began to turn its pages. She soon saw he had been right to warn her it would take a little while before she was comfortable in the presence of such a distinguished mind. But she persevered, and gradually began to get the measure of the great man's precise, exacting prose. It was not an easy read, but she enjoyed the challenge it posed. And by the end of the week, she hurried to the library eagerly, keen to discuss what she had read. Mr. Collins was waiting for her, his papers pushed aside.
So, Miss Bennet, I look forward to hearing what you have learned from your first encounter with one of the most profound thinkers of the ancient world.
I read it with much interest, sir, and I have made a few notes.
An excellent habit in a scholar, which I hope will enable you to explain clearly to me what Aristotle has taught you about happiness.
You want me to describe my impressions? Mr. Collins nodded. For a moment, Mary hesitated, but took a quick breath and began. Aristotle tells us we can be truly happy only when we are virtuous. And by that, I think he means when we behave in a way that promotes our goodness, that brings out our best qualities.
Yes, go on.
But it is often difficult for us to recognize what virtue looks like, because we so readily confuse it with pleasure. Pleasure can deliver us enjoyment, the feelings we derive from good food, good conversation, the contemplation of beauty. But these things do not last. Enjoyments are transient, but true happiness endures. That is its distinguishing quality.
Indeed. And how does Aristotle suggest such happiness is to be achieved?
Well, it is hard to sum up his thoughts succinctly without losing the subtlety of their perceptions.
But if I press you to do so, Miss Bennet?
Then I should say he tells us it is only through self-knowledge that genuine happiness is to be had. Only when we know ourselves, when we have examined and understood our strengths and weaknesses, when we have been honest enough to admit what we really desire from life, only then do we have any chance at all of attaining it. Mr. Collins was delighted.
Bravo, Miss Bennet! A most convincing summary! We shall make a classical scholar of you yet!
Mary returned his smile, a little self-conscious but eager to continue. Do you think we might go on, sir, to the end of the book?
I think we must, or we shall never know how his ideas develop. You must read a little more, and then we shall talk about it again.
The more Mary read, the more her confidence grew. In her next discussion with Mr. Collins, she articulated her thoughts more readily and with greater clarity. The silence, which had once been the library's defining quality, was replaced by animated conversation, conducted with such energy that eventually, even Charlotte noticed it. One afternoon, as she and Mary worked in the garden, she observed this was the first time they had been outside together for more than a week. "You seemed to be having a very lively time of it today. I hope Mr. Collins is not boring you. He is apt to be passionate on those subjects that interest him, and it can be very fatiguing. You must not feel obliged to keep him company, you know." "But I'm not in the least bored, I promise you. On the contrary, I have found it extremely interesting, and am very grateful for the time and trouble Mr. Collins has bestowed upon me." At this, Charlotte looked sharply in Mary's direction. Mary, pulling up a particularly stubborn weed, did not notice and went on. "Should you not like to pursue some course of study yourself, Charlotte? Mr. Collins makes it all so easy. I'm sure you would find it as stimulating as I do. Why don't you join us?" "I'm afraid I have enough to occupy me already, with a house to run and a child to look after. I have no leisure to spend my mornings discussing philosophy. What, I wonder, would Aristotle have to say about that?" Mary, attacking the unresponsive earth with a trowel, did not catch the hint of acerbity in her tone. "Very little, I expect. You are quite right. Aristotle does not show much interest in how women achieve happiness, or indeed in women at all. I shall ask Mr. Collins about that at our next discussion." Charlotte stood up suddenly, dropping her scissors into her apron pocket and handing Mary her basket. "I must go and see about dinner. I shall leave you to bring in the flowers." She did not say goodbye, but marched briskly and unsmilingly away. Mary watched her go, puzzled, at a loss to understand how she had offended. She was still a little nervous when she sat down to dinner, afraid of provoking Charlotte further, but Charlotte seemed herself again, presiding over the table with her usual orderly calm. Or was there perhaps the very faintest change in her manner, a new watchfulness, so subtle and so imperceptible that Mary was barely sure it was there at all? As the meal ran its course, she told herself she had been mistaken, but she could not put herself quite at ease and was glad when they rose from the table.
Later, as Mrs. Hill brushed out her hair, Mary did not respond to her attempts to engage her in conversation. Her thoughts returned again and again to Charlotte's state of mind, until she felt she had exhausted every attempt to understand her behaviour and resolved to consider it no longer. Once Mrs. Hill had gone, she picked up her Aristotle and read a few lines before blowing out the candle and attempting to get to sleep. Chapter 40. The next morning, Mary watched Mr. Collins closely when he arrived in the library to see if his demeanour suggested Charlotte had confided the source of her irritation to him, but he seemed unaware of any ill feeling. On the contrary, he seemed in buoyant spirits.
"I have a proposition for you, Miss Bennet. As you have demonstrated such a taste for classical learning, I have been reflecting on whether it would be proper for me to lead you more deeply into the study of this great treasury of human knowledge."
He sat down beside her.
"I have considered it most carefully, and, taking into consideration your great steadiness of temper, have concluded no harm is likely to come of it. I am satisfied what I intend will not be productive of any adverse consequences."
He pulled from his coat pocket a small and rather battered volume and laid it before her.
"This is a dictionary of the Greek language, together with a grammar suitable for beginners. It is old, as you can see, but in my humble opinion remains the best of its kind. It was mine as a boy. I had an excellent tutor who taught me to love the language. It was he who gave me this little book. It is not an easy study, but one which richly repays the efforts made to master it, and all attempts to do so must start first with the principles laid out herein."
Mary put down her pen, astonished. "Are you suggesting I should learn Greek, sir?"
"Indeed I am. I am aware it is not usually regarded as a suitable subject for young ladies, but if you will forgive an observation of a personal nature, I have never met a woman with interests as scholarly as your own. I think that you are perfectly equal to it."
He leant over and opened the pages.
"Look, here is the alphabet in its entirety. This is Alpha, and here at the end is Omega. You have surely heard of them. And here are all the others in between, with the sounds they make written beside them."
She rubbed her glasses with her sleeve and stared intently at the unfamiliar shapes.
"What do you think, Miss Bennet? If you are willing, I am prepared to make a trial of it with you."
For a moment she hesitated. It would be like learning to read all over again, with entirely new letters to master, and what if she should fail? But then excitement rose up in her, and she knew she could not refuse.
"Oh, yes, Mr. Collins, I should like it of all things."
He smiled.
"So should I, Miss Bennet, so should I."
Mary's first exercise was to memorize the Greek letters. She sat alone in the library with the little grammar and a large pile of paper, staring at them till her eyes ached, tracing their shapes with her pen whilst sounding out their names under her breath. Sometimes Mr. Collins insisted she repeat them to him out loud. At first, she feared to appear ridiculous, but he would have none of that, and soon she had conquered her embarrassment, speaking up clearly and without shame. She made excellent progress, and one afternoon, as they all sat at tea, Mr. Collins asked his wife if she would like to hear her friend recite the letters of the Greek alphabet.
"She has worked very hard, and I am sure, my dear Charlotte, you will be astonished to hear how she has advanced."
Mary looked up from her cup, a blush rising in her face. She caught Charlotte's expression as she did so, and it was suddenly very plain to her that Charlotte would take no pleasure at all in hearing her perform. She stumbled through the letters, unsettled by Charlotte's level, appraising stare,
which grew tighter with every low, excited prompt with which Mr. Collins helped Mary towards Omega and the end. When she finished, it was he who alone clapped his hands.
"Well done, Miss Bennet. You are a tribute to the value of hard work and an ornament to your sex. What do you think, Mrs. Collins? Has she not done well?"
Charlotte gazed at Mary with an expression of mild curiosity, as though she was seeing her clearly for the first time.
"I see you have been making excellent use of your time in the library. I had not understood before quite how you occupied yourself there, but I see now what you have been doing. Well done, indeed."
"We will make a scholar of you yet, Miss Bennet,"
exclaimed Mr. Collins.
"I am quite sure of it. But I shall hear no more from you today. Mrs. Collins, you will recall I shall not be in to dinner tonight, as I have business in Hartford. I must leave you two ladies to entertain yourselves."
Still smiling with pleasure at the progress of his pupil, Mr. Collins rose and left the table. Once he was gone, Charlotte poured the last of the tea into her cup. She did not offer any to Mary.
"As Mr. Collins will not be here, I think I will go to bed early tonight. I do not feel like eating. I'm sure Mrs. Hill will bring something up to you if you want it."
"I am sorry you are so tired, Charlotte. Is there anything I can do to help? I am quite at leisure for the rest of today."
"No, thank you. I'm sure I will manage well enough on my own, but we may not see much of each other, as I expect to be very busy."
After that, Charlotte was silent, and soon, with a rather chilly nod, she too took her leave. Alone at the table, Mary felt a growing sense of apprehension. This time there could be no mistaking Charlotte's displeased tone, nor, Mary feared, the source of her irritation. She resented the time Mary spent in the library with Mr. Collins. The word "jealous" sought to make itself heard in Mary's mind, but she would not allow it to do so. It was such a ridiculous idea, so foolish and so fantastical, that Charlotte could not seriously entertain it. It was hard to imagine two people less likely to be guilty of any impropriety than Mr. Collins and herself. She was not the kind of woman to whom men made themselves agreeable, and he was hardly the man to attempt it. Once her anger had subsided, Charlotte would surely see the truth of this. A little cool consideration must persuade her of the injustice of her suspicions. Mary had always thought of Charlotte as the calmest and least emotional of beings, and her feelings for her husband did not seem passionate enough to have overwhelmed her capacity for rational judgment. Her indignation could not last. Charlotte would soon be her usual self once more, dry, measured, and collected, able to laugh at an idea that was really too preposterous to imagine. Mary would say nothing about it at all. Not a hint, not a word of anything untoward had ever passed between herself and Mr. Collins. This was the truth. She would not dignify any other supposition by even attempting a denial, and indeed resolved to think of it no further. In search of distraction, she wandered into the library, took out pen and paper, and prepared to practice her Greek letters. She pulled out the little dictionary and hesitated for a moment before opening its pages. What if Charlotte should see and ask her where she got it? Oh, but this was ridiculous. She had done nothing wrong and would not be made to feel a guilt she did not deserve. She leant the book against another and began to write, speaking the names of the letters very quietly under her breath.